probably not that clearly. I didn't think, oh, I want to play Carnegie Hall one day, or I want to play wherever. I did. One big dream of mine was to play with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers.
And you did
And I actually did. And it was one of those law of attraction things, really. Before I ever heard of that, you know, that, I mean, I've, my life has kind of happened that way. And, you know, when I was in high school, I had a band with my buddies, like Rich Morgan from Morgan Music and Dennis Luganbill, who's over at Memorial High School, and Mike Walk from Chippewa on alto sax. You know, we went and saw Art Blakey live in at Lawrence, you know,
oh,
in 1985, and it was a blizzard outside, and we begged my dad to drive us 4 hours in this big old 1979 Lincoln Continental that got about a half a mile to the gallon.
Right kind of car to go through snow, though.
Yes, and to get struck by lightning in. We drove through a lightning bolt on a separate occasion. In fact, this is maybe where the piano skills come from, I think, if there are any. We were driving down a highway in one of those beautiful summer lightning storms that you don't see anywhere except the Midwest, you know, and this bolt hit right in front of the car, and literally we drove through it at about 50 miles an hour, and I saw blue light wrap around the car. It actually literally started in the front and wrapped around it and went out the back, and my hair stood straight up.
Whoa.
Like, and it was, you know, I'm, of course, loud, bang, but it was the coolest thing. I mean, and
was this just about around the time that Back to the Future was popular?
It really was like that.
Because they had that same effect.
It was a total DeLorean experience.
Except it was in a Lincoln.
It was in a Lincoln. And we heard Art Blakey play, going back to the story, and I was about 14 years old, and I went, and it was that band he had in the mid-80s with Mulgrew Miller on piano and Terrence Blanchard. They were all very young. And I went, this is what I want to do. I want to be in this band. I really, 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 really want to be in this band. I just sort of focused all my energy on that and on that music and learned it all. And I said, if I ever get to really be in this band, I'm going to know the whole book from memory before I ever get there. Then I got to Berklee College of Music in Boston, 1989, and I joined the Art Blakey Ensemble, which was led by Bill Pierce, who was a tenor saxophonist and alumnus of the Art Blakey band as well. We rehearsed right next to the Iron Maiden Ensemble. And these guys were loud, man. We couldn't hear ourselves, you know. They were in there with their Marshalls cranked up to 10, 11 maybe. And
I feel bad because I know more about Iron Maiden than I do Blakey, so sorry.
That band rocks. they know how to put on a good show, for sure. I actually was drawn to that music as well in high school. I loved jazz, but I loved heavy metal, and I loved the Basie band, and I loved Beethoven symphonies and Bach organ pieces, because it all was coming from the same place for me, energetically, if not musically. You know, it just felt big and powerful and fun, and I could groove off of Ozzy Osbourne, or I could groove off of Count Basie, or off E. Power Biggs playing, you know, the Toccata in D minor. I mean, what a name. That says it all.
Organ player.
You know, and this guy made that organ sound like a universe.
Is that his real name?
I believe so. Oh. I don't know. But that was really a defining moment for me, hearing Art Blakey play live. And then when I went to school in Boston, he would come through to the Regatta Bar. and play, and Benny Green was the pianist in the band at the time, and Benny introduced me to Art, as well as a pianist named James Williams, who also was in Art's band in the 70s, and James became kind of a mentor, introduced me to Art, said, hey, Art, there's this young pianist you should hear. So I had a lot of people sort of all talking to him about me, so Art let me sit in with the band, and of course, having, you know, this experience playing all his music with my band in high school with Dennis and Rich and those guys, and in college, I knew all the music. So by the time I got a chance to actually play with the real Art Blakey, I was ready, I felt. And I remember this is in the days before anyone had to worry about identity theft or any of these things. I was sitting by the door of the club up in Boston after I sat in with them. Art came up to me and goes, give me your passport copy and social security number. I looked at him, what?
Yeah.
He said, I need your information. You're going to be a jazz messenger soon.
Ooh.
And I went, wow, really? What does that mean? I don't know.
Did you celebrate?
Well, I didn't. I mean, it wasn't anything definite. It was just this sort of promise that he was. I was going to be in his band. And a few months later, I moved to New York City with a friend of mine from Berkeley, really without any game plan at all. I didn't move to New York thinking, oh, I'm going to play with Art Blakey. I didn't have any job offer. I just knew that jazz happened in New York, and that's where I wanted to live.
Yeah.
I didn't even really tell my parents. I just sort of moved there and then called them up and said, guess what? I live in New York now. They said, really? That's great. How are you going to live? Do you need some cookies? You know, I think.
And what years were these?
This is 89, 88. Okay. And then within a week of moving to New York, Art Blakey's tour manager called my phone in my apartment. Still to this day, I have no idea how he got my phone number, how he even knew I was there. But he said, hey, you know, I work for Art Blakey. He wants you to start with him at Sweet Basil in September. And I went, of course. Because it was the law of attraction,
just
man.
Say, it's about time.
I knew it. It just didn't know when, but that's what it was. And it was a dream gig for me in a lot of ways.
How long did that last?
1 year. Okay. Art passed away at the end of that year, fall of 1990. In fact, one of the last gigs that he was scheduled to do that he really wanted to do was here in Eau Claire. We played in the arena, part of the artist series at the time. Art didn't live to see the gig, and we actually did play the gig with a different drummer, but he really wanted to do it. You know, he said, I talked to your daddy. I want to play in your hometown, you know?
Wow, that's cool.
I was also studying classical piano with Don Patterson at the university. He'll probably tell you I was probably one of his worst students of all time. You know, I have a healthy respect for classical music, and I love it. Now, I love to listen to it. I love to listen to it played well, and I go to concerts all the time. And when I hear that music played on the piano, I think, well, that's really what that instrument is meant for. You know, it doesn't sound like that in any other form of music. I mean, you really hear the piano and everything it can do, you know. Jazz guys, we tend to use it a bit more like a percussion instrument, although you can access some of those qualities of classical music, some of the voice leading and some of the more legato touch, but we tend to play it a little more percussively, and jazz sometimes can be more about the information you're getting across more than the touch or the sound.
How do you feel about your piano? How do you feel about the instrument that you're playing? We were talking tools a while ago. Is that what a piano is to you, or is it your best friend? Is it
my girlfriend, my wife?
Because it's so important to you. It is. Yeah. It's your alter ego. It might even be your ego, for all I know.
Music is definitely hardwired into my DNA, and it's a big part of the way I experience life, this life, mm-hmm. as a human being. I mean, I hear music 24 hours a day. It's hard to turn off sometimes. My dreams have soundtracks. I sometimes have synesthetic experiences where, you know, that right when you're sort of on the verge of falling asleep, that's where music really becomes other things. The events of the day or memories or any sort of visual kind of experience that you can remember or think of becomes associated with music, with a musical idea or a melody or
really?
Something. You know, so it's very hard to separate music from anything else in my life. But I love music. I love to express myself that way. Mm. I think I'm a lot gentler and kinder to my music than I probably am to my body or to my loved ones or anyone. You know, I sometimes I think I get the equation upside down.
So you're one of these people that hears music in just regular things?
Yeah, I think so.
Because I've read where people hear music in traffic, and they hear music in air hammers, and they
yeah, maybe not in a direct sense, like, you know, Messiaen would go out and study bird calls and then write them down and write them into his pieces. I don't think I do it quite that literally. It's certainly hard to separate the sort of environment of music from everyday life for me, you know.
I read somewhere that wildlife is in the key of A.
Is it?
I may be wrong there.
The pyramids are in F sharp.
Are they?
All the pyramids, which is really interesting. The ones in Mexico, the Mayan pyramids, and the ones in Egypt. And I think there is one in Hawaii somewhere, like a hidden one in the jungle somewhere. And they went in there and figured out what you know, like when you sing in the shower resonates at a certain frequency. Mm-hmm. Every pyramid is in F sharp.
Wow.
Which I don't know what that means, but it's interesting.
I don't either. Let's talk about perspective. You're different today than you were 10 years ago. You're also a different guy. I mean, you're a father, and
yeah.
you do all the regular things that all of us regular people do on a daily basis. How has marriage and parenthood and that kind of stuff changed Jeff Keyser?
That's a tough thing to deal with every day. My job requires that I'm gone from home a lot of the time.
Mm.
You know, a lot of my friends that I grew up with chose to stay at home and teach. We need good teachers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And someone like Bob Baca or Dennis Luganbill, these guys are fantastic. In fact, the Midwest, and I'm not just saying that because I'm on the radio in Wisconsin, but I mean, I've traveled the world, and they really have some strong music programs out here where they don't necessarily exist everywhere now, you know, but it's always encouraging to come back here to Wisconsin and just hear how good everyone plays and,
mm-hmm.
and my gosh, they've raised the bar so high and they're all just doing great, great kids. And it's a special place out here. It really is.
Guys like you are a busy professional combination. There's Keyser the composer, Keyser the performer, Keyser the promoter, Keyser the producer, Keyser the ambassador, Keyser the mentor. And I'm getting fatigued just mentioning all those. Is there one of those that stands out? Making music is the first one because the other stuff totally depends on it.
Yeah, gosh. All those things are probably just by default. I mean, all I really ever wanted to do is just be a good musician. But
when you become a good musician, then you are required to do those other things.
I suppose people, you know, want to know how you do it. I remember growing up in Eau Claire, and I remember the jazz festivals every year, how the different guest artists would come through, the clinicians. I remember guys like Ernie Watts came through one year, Rufus Reed, I don't know, Don Menzies, Ashley Alexander, some of these guys that would come through. Some of them were guys more on the touring circuit, the kind of New York kind of guys. Some of them were more in the educational circuit, and they sort of were professional educators, professional clinicians. Sometimes you'll get a jazz musician, or, well, not necessarily a jazz musician, any musician or any artist of any genre or style who is really good at what they do, highly creative, but not so good at teaching or communicating. You know, for example, you'll ask somebody, well, last night, when you started to play that tenor saxophone solo and you just took us to the stratosphere and it was just amazing. And what were you thinking about? You know, there's a right way to answer that and the wrong way. And the wrong way is like, man, I don't know. I just play, you know, that's true. You do just play, but I mean, there is a process, you know, and I was always thankful when I could interface with a great artist who could also teach. Rufus Reed was that way. Benny Golson is like that. You ask Benny a question, he'll tell you. You ask Gary Burton or Chick Corea or Herbie Hancock. I mean, and these are the guys. These are the real, you know, the real innovators, the true, you know, geniuses of this music. And I remember having an experience when I was 18 years old. I went to see Herbie Hancock play at the Blue Note in New York City with his trio. You know, I'd been transcribing him. I'd been studying him, learning his stuff. And I went right up to him. He had only been off stage maybe 4 or 5 minutes, just played a spellbinding set of music for probably an hour and a half or 2 hours straight. People were still paying their checks, still sitting at the tables. And I said, Mr. Hancock, can I ask you a couple questions? And he goes, sure, you know, sure, you know. That's my Herbie impression. And
it's a good one.
And I said, well, what's the correct turnaround on footprints? And what is the last four chords on Dolphin Dance? And what's that voicing on Eye of the Hurricane? There's very specific musical questions I wanted to know. And he goes, oh, well, here, I'll show you. Herbie takes me up on stage. You know, like I said, people are still sitting in their seats, paying their checks. And he sat me down at the piano and gave me like a 10-minute private piano lesson right there. And it wasn't like, hey, kid, I just got off stage. I don't have time to talk to you right now. You know, call my manager. It wasn't any of that stuff. He was just like, oh, yeah, well, it was like this, 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 and this. And he explained to me exactly why he came up with those particular voicings on the piano. And that experience, I think, more than any other, along with others, has stuck with me. Because, I mean, this is Herbie Hancock, you know? I find myself in Herbie's position now, and young musicians try to ask me things. And I try not to hold anything back. I feel, okay, I'll show you, you know? Mm-hmm. I've done that exact thing just to see if I could replicate that experience from the other side, just to see what it felt like, you know?
When you write something for someone else, does a composer of your ilk just hand it to them and let them do with it what they may? Or do you offer advice and say, you know, I wrote this for a reason and it needs to be there? Do you ever wince when someone goes off on a whole different tangent with something that you've written?
No, actually, I think that's kind of fun. I don't really get to hear other people play my music very often. When they do, it's kind of fun, and I actually like it if they do something completely different with it.
What's new on the horizon? What's out there? What are you working on?
Oh, gosh. Well, over the summer, I recorded a new solo piano CD.
Where do you like to record? Do you move around?
This one I recorded at a private residence in San Diego. Wealthy patrons of the arts that have a real nice piano in their house, did it with these audiophile guys out there that invented some new microphone. And well, the way it's recorded, it has to be downsampled or downgraded to like an actual sample rate that you can play on any kind of machine, because they have this machine. I think it records it at 320 K, whatever that means, you know.
That's going over my head.
It sounds great if you listen to it on their system. I mean, it literally sounds like you're right in the room. So it's a real high-end audiophile thing. So I'm thinking of releasing it on vinyl for the audiophile nuts.
Sure.
We'll put it out sometime next year. I don't have a label for it yet. I might just do it on my own. Not sure, but it's in the can. Started working on a big band record a couple years ago.
Mm.
Actually, the UWEC Jazz Ensemble donated a day of their time to me to record a couple of big band pieces. Mm. I flew a rhythm section out from New York. We set up in Regis High School, just set up a little mobile recording rig in there, and recorded two songs. It's actually a suite I wrote called Three Love Poems, which I wrote for Julia Dollison, singer. She's going to put her vocal part on it, and we have to just edit it and add a couple things here and there and do some mixing, and that'll be done.
Wow.
A lot of stuff living on little flash drives at the moment.
So now this concert that you performed in, called Essentially Eau Claire, that's kind of a neat title. It's a first annual, and pretty neat that you're breaking the champagne bottle on the concept.
Yeah, why not?
You are Essentially Eau Claire.
I guess so.
It's so great that you come back to the roots every once in a while. That's neat.
It's a beautiful town. You know, maybe when I retire, not in the winter, but...
And as much as you talked about the Midwest being a hotbed for music, you can really focus in on Eau Claire. It's amazing to me how many people I run across who are very, very good at what they do.
It must be something in the water.
Claire. It's Claire. It's clear water. Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for being a great guy. And that is meant to encompass both your music and your willingness and your enthusiasm and your personality.
Thank you.
You're a nice combo, Jeff Keyser, and that's a term. That's a term you can relate with, kid.
Combo, especially when it's comes to ordering at Jack in the Box.
Well, there are also those cheap cheese snacks you can buy. Those are called combos.
Oh, that's
too.
Right.
But that's not the relation I wanted you to make. I mean,
that's me. I'm a cheap cheese snack.